In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start off this series of quick conversations about the news week with highlights from the Iowa State House. I'm joined by Katarina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. And today, the governor signing legislation having to do with in-person learning. Katarina, start us off with that.
Right. So Governor Reynolds, in her condition of the state address, said this is one of her biggest priorities, is to get kids back into in-person school, even though, you know, the pandemic is still going on and teachers have not had the opportunity to be vaccinated yet. She asked lawmakers to send her a bill immediately, and the House and the Senate both passed the same bill yesterday. It requires all schools to offer the option of 100% in-person learning, and it would give them about 2 weeks to get that to start in-person learning. And then Democrats have had concerns about, you know, they're trying to delay this until teachers can all get vaccinated, but Republicans rejected that suggestion.
Also, some movement on the school choice bill. Tell us about that, Katarina.
Reynolds proposed this bill that would put public funding into independent charter schools and give some family state money to spend on private schools as well. So Senate Republicans have advanced that. They're saying it gives students a chance to leave struggling schools. Democrats are concerned that it would divert funding from the public schools that need it and make struggling schools even worse off. So this passed the Senate yesterday, 26-21. A few Republicans actually joined Democrats in voting against it. And while the Senate Republicans have really fast-tracked this bill, House Republican leaders are saying it wouldn't happen that fast on their side. And they really want to take time to go through the bill, and they haven't fully declared support or opposition for Reynolds' proposal yet.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of interest across the state among educators, among parents, about this bill. We'll be dedicating a good portion of Monday's River to River, this program on Monday, to that school choice issue that you just talked about, Katarina. Let's talk about gun rights. That's something you've been reporting on over the past few weeks. That has advanced as well, hasn't it?
Right. The House and Senate yesterday approved this language for a gun rights constitutional amendment. Now it can go on the ballot in 2022 for voters to have the final say on whether it should be added to the Iowa Constitution. So it would add some gun rights language that is not identical to the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So it actually requires courts to use the highest standard of judicial review when evaluating any gun restrictions or gun laws. Democrats are concerned that this would be used to dismantle Iowa's existing gun laws. And Republicans are saying that they need this language that goes further than the Second Amendment, because they see there being threats to gun rights, even though, you know, Republicans are in control of the state government and have appointed most of Iowa's Supreme Court justices.
Mm-hmm. And this will, the final stage of making this constitutional language change would be on a ballot at some point for Iowa voters, wouldn't it?
Right. And so that would be, at this point, that would be next year.
In 2022, Iowa voters to have the final say in the Second Amendment language change in the Iowa Constitution. Also, advances in the constitutional language concerning abortion this week as well.
Right. So there's been an effort for the past few years to add language to the Iowa Constitution that would say it doesn't protect abortion rights. So the Senate has passed it last year. But the House Republicans didn't have enough support last year to pass it. This year, very different. They've increased their majority. The House ended up passing it this week. And so the Senate is going to start considering that same proposal on Monday. But, of course, with the very long process of amending the Constitution, 2024 is probably the earliest that we would see this language on the ballot for voters to decide.
Mm-hmm. Go into a little bit more detail about how Democrats have criticized what Republicans are laying the groundwork for.
Yeah, so Democrats say that this could lead to a full ban on abortion. That's a lot of other things would have to happen for that to take place, including at the federal level. But what this would definitely do is open the door to more abortion restrictions in Iowa. Right now, there's very strong constitutional protections for abortion rights in the state constitution, making it difficult for Republicans to pass abortion restrictions in the legislature that would actually hold up in court. And then this would make that a lot easier for them.
Mm-hmm. Here's one that caught my attention, at least new to me this week. Republicans on an Iowa House panel voting to advance a bill that would make political ideology a protected class. We have race, age, sex, religion protected classes. This would add political ideology?
Yes. So this is something that was brought up by Representative Stephen Holt, who's a Republican who's in charge of the House Judiciary Committee. He was saying this is the response to, so-called cancel culture, which is something that there's a lot of debate about what that even is and if it's even a thing. Some people on the right think that cancel culture is equates to censorship. So the thing is, the Iowa Civil Rights Act bans discrimination in things like employment, housing, and public accommodations, things like that. So mm-hmm. This isn't something that would, stop someone from being canceled on Twitter, for example. But this is, there are a lot of concerns from LGBTQ advocacy groups, from the ACLU of Iowa, that this would have a lot of unintended consequences. And generally, the Iowa Civil Rights Act is to be used for to protect characteristics that are you can't change about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. We'll follow that, see how that develops. Thank you for the update, Katerina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter. Take care, Katerina. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Good to have you with us on this Friday News Buzz edition. It's been nearly a month since the deadly January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by pro-Trump rioters. We heard this week in our news a second police officer who defended the U.S. Capitol during that mob attack has died by suicide. The attack followed an unprecedented campaign by former President Donald Trump to overturn the election results. IPR's Kate Payne reported this week on how Iowa Republicans have been reacting in the weeks since the Capitol insurrection. She joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Start off by telling us, in the lead up to this January 6th attack, which shocked us, shocked the nation, how did Iowa Republicans deal with Trump's baseless allegations of widespread election fraud?
So what we saw from top Republicans is that over time, they largely stood by him during this time. Iowa Republicans, by and large, have been incredibly loyal to the president, and they've delivered for him, he's delivered for them. And at times, top Republicans also reinforced, echoed these baseless allegations from Trump of widespread voter fraud, lending credibility to his taking his cases to court, these cases that were thrown out again and again by judges because of lack of evidence, because of lack of basis in fact. We really saw Iowa Republicans, stand by him in this.
Mm-hmm. Any differentiation there when we look at our U.S. senators, Grassley and Ernst, the GOP members of the House, Hinston, Feenstra, and also Iowa lawmakers? Any differentiation there that you could see?
So one that sticks out to me is one of the new congresswomen, Ashley Hinton, and she signed a letter with some House colleagues actually the day before the riot. A letter expressing, acknowledging that members of Congress could not overturn the Electoral College results, but still, again, underlining those allegations of fraud. And that was certainly a public statement from her, you know, putting her name to this formal letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We also saw, after the attack, Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks also continued this line of, you know, there are questions, there was fraud, and this needs to be looked at. In response to questions from IPR, Senator Chuck Grassley did clarify, yes, you know, any amount of fraud, any irregularities need to be looked at. But he said that there is no evidence that any of those issues made a difference in this race. And that's, of course, a very important note, which has been borne out that with elections of this scale in the United States, yes, there are going to be isolated clerical errors, isolated mistakes, but that research and these court cases demonstrate that they are not making a difference in this race.
And not only were there are these baseless allegations of widespread election fraud, but this is deemed the most secure election in U.S. history by many experts, isn't it?
So yes, that was the unanimous statement from a coalition of federal officials, industry experts, and that's one of the just incredible disappointments, certainly for election workers across the country who undertook this just Herculean effort during a global pandemic to ensure that this election was safe, to ensure that people had different ways to make their voices heard, to get to the polls, and for that outcome to be vetted, to be checked, as we have these checks and balances built into the system. Just an incredible operation by them. And so for their work to be called into question needlessly without evidence is quite damaging.
In your reporting, you point out that Iowa's Republican leaders have largely stood by the former president and his baseless claims of widespread fraud here in this past election. But there is division here. You spoke with former Iowa Republican Congressman Jim Leach, a Republican who had some harsh things to say, representing the other side of this divide in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I think that's consistent with, you know, some of the voices that we've seen publicly come out and condemn the president. The few voices that we've seen from Iowa Republicans, their former members, like former Congressman Jim Leach, former Congressman Tim Nussel, who has left the party after the attack. They're not necessarily, you know, current leaders. We also saw in Scott County, the Scott County GOP chair, Dave Milledge, also came forward and said that he thought the president should be impeached, but got so much pushback that he resigned. He's no longer the chair of the Scott County Republican Party, which tells you something about the popularity of that belief, you know, that we're not seeing those statements being made publicly.
And so going forward, when you talk about this split, and it looks, it's very apparent in the last couple of weeks since the Capitol attack, while the president's national approval ratings, the former president's national approval ratings have fallen sharply, including among Republicans, you point out in your reporting that the former president and supporters are still credited and may be credited in the future. We'll see. It depends on the voters for the good results that the Republicans enjoyed in this latest election here in Iowa.
Absolutely. So Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman told reporters, you know, just recently, the party is at an absolute peak right now as far as up and down the ticket, flipping seats, holding seats, engagement, fundraising. Sort of any way that you can look at it, the party has really excelled and succeeded under Donald Trump's tenure, and that's very convincing for many Iowa Republicans, regardless of everything else that's happened.
Okay, we look forward to your future reporting, Kate Payne, and we'll end it as you end your report. People can find it at iowapublicradio.org. That's the voters in Iowa will decide what role Donald Trump will play in the Republican Party going forward. Kate Payne, Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, beliefs about climate change are changing among farmers. That's according to the latest Iowa Farm and Rural Life poll. Jay Arbuckle directs the poll. He's a professor of sociology at Iowa State University, an extension sociologist, and he is joining us now. Jay Arbuckle, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, the poll, you've been looking at farmers' attitudes about climate change since 2011, I believe. What are the most significant changes you're seeing in this latest poll?
Well, so I think probably what really jumped out at first is the shifts in climate change beliefs. In 2011, less than half of the farmers that we polled, about 45%, indicated that climate change was caused at least in part by humans, which is, the scientific consensus, of course, is that climate change is caused by humans. And now that stat has increased to almost 60%. And overall, 80% of farmers believe that climate change is happening, some of them believing that it's due primarily to natural causes. And that, too, is up from 68% in 2011. So, further, that 81% is quite a bit higher than the 67% of adult Iowans that indicated the same in a recent poll by the Yale Program on Climate Change. So that's a big shift.
Right. And it based on what you just said, it seems like the farmers' beliefs about climate change are converging with the actual scientific consensus by the huge majority of climate scientists.
Yep, moving in that direction for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think is really important about that is belief in climate change. The belief structure is really related to support for different kinds of action. So, for example, almost 40% of the farmers we polled supported government action on greenhouse gas reduction, and pretty much all of those farmers are the ones that indicated they believe humans are causing climate change, as you might anticipate. So really, beliefs are important.
Right, and this dovetails with the news this week, President Biden issuing executive orders having to do with aggressively tackling climate change, much more than the Trump administration. Comment on how you see those actions fitting in with the farmers' attitudes you've just polled.
Yeah, so that's one of the questions that we put in there was about programs and or markets for carbon capture and whether they should be developed to help farmers earn money from adopting practices that capture greenhouse gases. And that's an idea that's been discussed, an idea that the discussion of that has waxed and waned over the years, but it's really going to be an important component of the Biden-Harris administration action on climate change and agriculture. And it really provides a lot of opportunities for farmers. And one of the things, or what we found in our poll, is that about a third of farmers agreed with that statement, supporting programs or markets for carbon capture. Mm-hmm. And about half were uncertain, but I take that as being kind of potentially open to the idea. So I think it bodes well to the possibility of those programs, which could benefit agriculture in Iowa a lot, being something that might have legs here in Iowa.
Mm, okay. Your poll, you also asked questions about the concern farmers have about climate change. What did you find there?
Well, certainly concern is rising, and also kind of going along with that is confidence in their capacity to cope with climate change seems to be declining. So between 2011 and 2020, we have a statement that we provided. I am concerned about the potential impacts of climate change on my farm operation. Mm-hmm. Percent of farmers agreeing with that statement increased from 35% to 51%. And then a percent of farmers agreeing with the statement crop insurance and other programs will protect my farm operations revenue declined from 46% to 33%. So a pretty big shift in concerns and confidence in their capacity to deal with climate change.
So not feeling more uneasy as they kind of grasp what this may mean for their business, for their operations in the ag sector.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's important because that concern or perceived risk is, you know, strongly related to attitudes toward action, especially towards adaptation actions that can make mm-hmm. a farm operation more resilient to immediate threats. You know, if you're concerned about something happening, of course, you're more likely to take action. And so, you know, I think that that gives a really excellent opportunity for agricultural stakeholders like Iowa State University Extension and, you know, Iowa Soybean Association and the corn growers to work with farmers to help them adopting practices like cover crops and no-till and so forth that really help to make farm operations more resilient. At the same time, they also address some of the carbon sequestration issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You also looked at what sources farmers turn to for information. What was revealed there?
Well, what we found was that farmers trust university extension and scientists most. And it's, you know, it's critically important to understand who farmers trust because that's who they're going to look to for guidance on what kinds of action to take, if any. And so, you know, extension and scientists are precisely the right entities for them to trust because scientists are doing the research that points to what needs to be done. And extension's role is to translate that science into actionable knowledge that helps society address problems that markets can't solve. So they're the most trusted sources of information. And what we found was that AM radio talk show hosts were about the least trusted mm-hmm. Sources of information on climate change. And that was a really interesting finding to me because when I was designing this survey, a lot of people told me, oh, farmers probably get all their information from radio talk show hosts that are saying that climate change is a hoax. And what mm-hmm. we found was that's not the case. In fact, farmers looked to scientists and university extension and not radio talk show hosts for mm-hmm.
climate change. Yeah, but what would be there to say about how Iowa farmers feel about talk show hosts such as yours truly? My colleagues and I rely on scientists and researchers such as those at ISU Extension. So we rely on only trusted sources and don't have it as a goal to give our opinions at all.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think probably when we put that item in there, radio talk show hosts, it was, you know, focused on kind of the opinionated, bloviating talk show hosts that we tend to hear on AM radio, not, you know, from programs like River to River.
Okay, good. I'm not in the bloviating category, Jay.
Definitely not.
Thank you. Jay Arbuckle is Iowa State University Sociology Professor, Extension Sociologist, Director of the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. Their new poll just out. Thanks for telling us about it, Jay.
Thanks, Ben.
After a short break, we'll have a COVID vaccination update from IPR's Natalie Krebs, and then we'll talk about the weather with Iowa State University climatologist Elwin Taylor. He'll tell us what all this snow means, record snow we had a few days ago in the Des Moines area, what that means for the rest of this winter and for the spring growing season. When we come back, it's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay with us.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition on this Friday. Quick conversations to end the news week. And as we keep our eyes on that winter storm watch we just heard about in our weather forecast, we'll be talking about weather in just a moment with climatologist Elwin Taylor of Iowa State University. Fascinating work that he does on the long-term forecast and how we get the weather we do in the Midwest. We broke a record dating back to 1895 in the Des Moines area from that last snowfall. We'll talk about that as well coming up in just a few minutes. But first, a COVID vaccination campaign update from our IPR health reporter, Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
So let's talk about this. All the states wrestling with this, a great demand for vaccinations across the country. Here in Iowa, also demand, but it seems short on supply, right?
Right. Yeah, that is the exact issue. And I've been talking to public health departments across the state, and the number one issue is just like not having enough doses of the vaccine. I mean, they're ready. Pharmacists, doctors, health departments are set up, ready to give the shot. But the state's only getting, you know, around 45,000 first doses a week now, and that is coming nowhere close to covering the, you know, more than 600,000 Iowans who fall into this first tier of phase 1B.
Okay, so explain a little bit more about the phases, because we're not so well acquainted with these different phases. We're in phase 1B. What came before? Who has been hopefully vaccinated voluntarily, and mm-hmm. who is up right now possibly to be vaccinated in the near future, depending on that supply?
Right, yeah, Ben, so lots of letters and numbers. So vaccine phase 1A covered healthcare workers and then long-term care facilities, so assisted living facilities and nursing homes. And those were vaccinated through a federal partnership with chain pharmacies. Starting February 1st, kind of the official-ish day, is phase 1B. So this includes Iowans who are 65 plus, and then also other frontline essential workers. And these other frontline essential workers have been broken into five tiers. So tier one is also eligible to start about February 1st, so Monday of next week. And that includes first responders, so police officers, firefighters and such, school staff, anyone employed in a, you know, pre-K through 12 school, and then child care workers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What should people do if they fall into these categories? How do you, should you receive a notification? Should you be reaching out? I know there's some confusion there, right?
Right. That is, well, this is the, you know, difficult part, because as I said before, you know, this first tier along with Iowan 65 plus, that's 600,000 people, and we do not have nearly that amount of vaccine in this state. So there is way higher demand than supply. You know, it really varies from public health departments. Polk County has an online sign up, very limited appointments, but you can go online and try to get one. And then other, you know, health departments, you can call in, they're taking names, they're making waiting lists. But for the most part, you know, even if you fall into this category, phase 1B, you might have to sit back and just wait until more vaccine arrives. Polk County health officials today, too, were recommending, you know, people just don't call your doctor, don't call your healthcare provider. Many clinics don't have the vaccine yet, and they will be contacting you if you are their established patient already when they do have the vaccine and you qualify to offer it to you. So it's sort of a waiting game, really, in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how much you've been looking into this, Natalie, but of course, we've been hearing a lot about the variants in this coronavirus. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention warned, for instance, that the UK variant could be dominant in the U.S. by spring. You hearing mm-hmm. any discussion about that from health officials here in Iowa?
Yeah, there has been discussion. You know, just in general, there are these warnings, these variants, one that's found in the UK that's going to be widespread. One that's found in South Africa that was identified first in South Carolina yesterday, according to the CDC, can spread more easily. You know, health officials are this is sort of just making the COVID-19 situation more dangerous. Health officials are, again, are warning Iowans, even though we have these vaccines out here, some people have been vaccinated, people still really need to wear a mask, keep their distance, really stay in as much as they can, especially if you're in a vulnerable group. You know, even consider, you know, starting to order your groceries if you're still just doing that once a week trip to the grocery store. So, you know, it's good news vaccines are here, but these variants are quite dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been so long, and it seems like it's been so long, over 10 months of this pandemic, Natalie Krebs, but we still have to not let our guard down. Mask up. Do yourself a favor. Do all those who are close to you a favor. Do those a favor in grocery stores, wherever you are. Social distancing. Stay away from those groups, especially indoors. Wash hands. We've said it so many times, Natalie. It is crucial that we hang on for a little bit more time, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, health officials are saying, too, even if you have been vaccinated, if you've gotten both doses, you know, waited the final week for it to be fully effective, you still need to be following these mitigation strategies, you know, by wearing a mask, you know, washing your hands, keeping distant, you know, just like you haven't been vaccinated. We're trying to reach that herd immunity, which is it's going to be quite a long time, months and months before we really reach that level, especially with the amount of doses we're being allocated at the moment. So it's just really important that, you know, life isn't really changing now. We still need to follow those really important public health mitigation strategies.
Right. A little bit of road in front of us before we get back to hopefully more normal conditions in the country. Natalie Krebs, IPR health reporter, thank you so much for your update.
Thank you, Ben.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We heard in our news this week that last batch of snowfall a few days ago broke a record in our state capital, one that was set way back in 1895. We just heard in our weather that winter storm watch. This weekend looks promising for more snow, perhaps freezing rain. We'll see what we get. Makes it an ideal time to talk with ISU Extension climatologist Elwin Taylor, well known for his analysis of weather influences here in the Midwest. Elwin, welcome back to our program.
Well, thank you very much, and it's good to be with you.
So let's talk about the past snow on Monday. Des Moines, I guess, hadn't seen a winter storm like Monday's for quite a while. How unusual was it? In what way was it unusual?
Well, if the newspaper's right, it's at least set a record for the date or something. But anyway, it reminded me of the Iowa that I moved to when I came here some many years ago. I did come to a below freezing condition. They wanted me to buy a house. I said, well, I got to inspect the roof and the shingles. So I walked up the snow drift right up onto the eaves and onto the roof.
saves the work of getting a ladder out, that's for sure.
Well, we haven't had the drifts that much around the house since then, but I assumed that maybe it's because I was sort of the last house on the north end of the city of Ames, and since then it's grown by about five or six blocks, a little more than half a mile buffer around me. So maybe the weather hasn't got better. We've just gotten more into the sheltering by other people having houses and fences and trees.
Right. And that National Weather Service telling us that record was broke that we read or heard about. 10.3 inches fell by the end of Monday, a new single day record. That was a 126-year-old mark for January 25th. Okay, let's put this in a little bit of context. We have a little more snow than last year, for sure. Overall, Elwin, how is this winter looking in terms of precipitation, temperatures? What are you seeing?
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing that we have, let's say, more snow, more precipitation than we've had in the immediate past. We do have a 89-year cycle of weather, and of course, to see this with a high amount of snow and some viciousness of the weather, you might say, you begin to look at it a little bit. I was looking at what the harshest winters have been in history, mm-hmm. and of course, history was being southeastern Iowa when we go back to 1846. And that was a harsh winter, followed by a harsh summer, cold winter, hot summer. Next round on that was 1935-36, that's 89 years later. And now here we are, almost 89 years later again. That seems to be the weather cycle, for at least here in the Midwest, is about 89 years, and we're getting back close to that. With a 24, 25 would be right at the point where we would expect to see that if we're going to have the same type of weather cycling through that we had back during the Dust Bowl, 35, 36, that's when we would expect it to be, because the tree ring histories tell us that that is the way things have gone for more than 600 years. about 89 years, we have a repeat. That's about what the cycle is of harshness.
Elwin, is there any, what would be the scientific basis for an 89-year cycle in what you just described? Do we know anything more about the why of that cycle?
Well, we have a lot of things that we're pretending, like we're figuring out. But why should it be an 89-year cycle? Why isn't it 100-year or something that's more comfortable to work with? Well, that's just the way the Earth works, apparently, with the changes of movement of the wet areas and the dry areas that affect a large part of the planet. And so that's the kind of thing that we're paying attention to, that scientists are trying to learn more about it. And I try to hope they don't say I left them an awful heritage when I became emeritus rather than a full-time professor.
Let's talk a little bit about the future, specifically the growing season. Planting and growing season still many weeks away. What about the conditions that we can tell at this point for that growing season?
Well, I've been paying attention to the moisture that we have, and it's not too bad for Iowa. For example, and for our immediate neighbors, I've communicated with several farmers during the last, well, several days even, and I asked them, have you been able to look at your tile outlets and or see the steam off of them? Are the tiles running? Mm. And 80% of them are. Still got some water coming out, still excess moisture in the top 5 feet of soil, a lot of the agricultural cropland. And so with that, we've got a desirable situation. We've got moisture in the soil. We've now got some snow cover on the top. The frost isn't deep in the soil. I got a report from a couple of people today that most of the frost in the soil is in the top 10 inches. So we haven't had a deep freeze like sometimes in northern Iowa, northwest Iowa. We've had the frozen moisture in the soil, the freeze go down to 5 feet and deeper. Usually I have to get these reports from the cemeteries or if they have to open a dig a new grave or something for a memorial, and they pay close attention to whether the soil is frozen or not, because that really determines how they can open a plot.
How interesting. What an interesting footnote. Let's talk. We know we have a winter storm watch ahead of us this weekend. I think some colder temperatures next week. Can you say anything about longer term, the rest of this winter? Any predictions or chances there?
I guess that the only thing we really have, if we want to look ahead to that, is that here we are with the cycle coming into the really harsh winters and harsh summers would be peaking around 2024. We're not very far from that. And if we look at what the buildup was back last time in this cycle, as we built toward the Dust Bowl in the Midwest, we're kind of seeing a repeat of those things. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see an almost exact repeat of what they had back during the Dust Bowl years. Hopefully we know something so there won't be so much dust in the air and erosion, but that doesn't mean the weather wouldn't be the same as it was back in 1935-36, wouldn't turn out the same in 2024-25, which is really what we're looking at on this, and that's only a couple 3 years away from us, and we're building up to what would I would think would be our likely harshest episode of the 89-year cycle that some people call the 100-year cycle. Wouldn't argue with them about that. There's not much difference between 89 and 100. It just looks like from tree rings it's 89 years that we get the cycle.
Well, before we say goodbye, we have less than a minute, Elwin. Of course, in that 600-year cycle you've been talking about, we have something new on the horizon, climate change. You're a climatologist. Do we know how that might change that cycle? Do we know what that will do when we put the human activity causing greenhouse gases into the mix?
Well, with humans really being a not the part of the problem rather than part of the solution, it seems like we do have to be kind of careful with this, as we have pushed the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere up higher than it would have been without our input. It is doing its part to make things increasingly harsh, both summer and winter, because it does have an effect on our atmosphere, not just on the ground we walk on.
Okay. Elwin Taylor, ISU Extension climatologist, professor emeritus at Iowa State University. Always nice to catch up with you, get your thoughts on our Midwest weather. Elwin, be well, stay safe, take care, stay warm.
Thank you very much. I wish everyone the best.
Okay. Let's finish off this News Buzz edition of River to River by, of course, on Fridays, grooving into the weekend. With us, Cece Mitchell, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Cece.
Hey there, Ben. Nice to hear from you.
Nice to contact you. Get us right into the groove. We've got a couple of tunes to listen to. What do you want to start us off with?
I'm going to start us off with a track by Still Corners. They are a super cool band out of London. I think this is their fifth record that they just released last week. I looked them up. They describe themselves as, quote, shimmering desert noir, which I think is a pretty, actually, an apt description. Yeah, yeah. Their music is kind of Western, kind of indie pop, and the vocals are from their frontwoman, Tessa Murray. She's got this, like, super beautiful, ethereal sort of voice added with this instrumentation that's kind of country, kind of indie pop, all over the place. Really fun to listen to. So this is the title track from Still Corners' brand new record, The Last Exit.
Well, Cece, that puts me in a good headspace. I know what you mean now by shimmering. Nice. We have time for one more tune.
Sure thing. Next one comes from Raye's new album. It's called Home. That's the project of Michael Milosh. He's from Canada. It's really also vocal heavy. He's got this R&B falsetto counter tenor voice, so it's high, and it's the star of the show in all of the music that Raye releases. It's super chill. It's upbeat and it's really fun, but at the same time, he's got this great, beautiful voice, and the electronic music around it is really casual. And when I listen to his music, it makes me feel cool, which I think is kind of important in music sometimes. So this track is called Black Rain from Raye's new album, Home.
Keep it tight.
Okay, I'm working on that. Makes me feel cool. I think it's working. Cece Mitchell, thanks for the grooving us into the weekend. Cece Mitchell, along with Mark Simmet and Tony Daner, your Studio One Tracks host, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. Take care, Cece. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Have a great one.
You too. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay safe. Have a great weekend.
The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Here First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I've spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Here First wherever you get your podcasts.